another place inclined for charity. Everyone begging for an answer without regard to validity. The searching never ends, it goes on and on and on for eternity.
Lying with those traded your life to bless your soul. And have they told you how to think? Cleanse your mind of sepsis and autonomy. Or have you escaped scrutiny and regaled yourself with depravity? Now we all see religion's a synthetic frippery, unnecessary in our expanding global cultural efficiency.
need some distance. You know my face, but I'm a drudgery. Don't you know responsibility? Cause I don't care a thing about it. Never mind. This is mine. It's more than a ride. It's your indecision. Your indecision. Your bad religion. Your duty. Indecision. It's not too late. Bad religion. Your duty. Indecision. It's not too late. Bad religion. Bad religion. Bad religion.
And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, yes, it's Bathrobes, Fears, Broadsides. Hoping to have a return visit from marijuana petitioner Pat Malo. We'll see if he makes it to the studio. Otherwise, we've got bits and pieces of all kinds of stuff, so don't go away.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me laugh. And ditties romantic drive me frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of boars and sing me of breadlines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Dress your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you. I want a song that's satirical, putting the mirror into miracle.
Welcome to another edition of, yes, Bathrob Spears Broadsides, 2 hours until 8. On my agenda tonight is more discussion of the upcoming statewide cannabis initiatives, which I'm hoping we can get a full account or a fuller account from Pat Malo, who was in the studio on Sunday. We'll see if that happens. Also, I should let you know that coming up on Sunday is call-in expected from the Brown and Black Coalition over in Monterey, that some of whom blocked the highway, similar to what was done by the Highway 6 here in Santa Cruz. The focus was very specifically on Black Lives Matter and police abuse over there. And it was, I wish we had done more ourselves here. Although I guess, you know, some students took it into the, you know, into their, well, they decided to do it, risking suspensions, well, getting suspended, and also facing numerous charges in court. I've actually interviewed some of those folks or some of the witnesses to the event. They had a benefit the other night at the India Joe's restaurant, and hopefully I'll be playing some of that tonight. Again, it depends on what I can slip in and how much I can restrain myself from my usual invaluable commentary. And also your phone calls, how much time they take up, which to me is very important. If I've got it on tape, it's here if we need it, and oftentimes what's been recorded gets mentioned later in other forums and by other guests or by me in commentary on what other guests or what other recorded interviews are telling us. So your call-ins, I try to do as a general rule, make them the first priority. So if you want to call in to this show, you can, and you're listening to Free Radio 101.3 FM, in case you didn't pick up on that immediately, if you're a new listener perhaps. 101.3 FM in Santa Cruz and across the world. We're at freakradio.org. Call-in number here is 831-427-3772. 831-427-3772. We also might be getting a call from out of town, pretty far out of town, actually. I contacted some homeless activists in Baltimore, Maryland, to see how police are treating them while, I don't know, disposing of the spine of Freddie Gray and then concealing the identities of the officers who did this so that we can't check into their records and find out if maybe they've been engaging in a little other mischief in the past. Of course, the focus is all on the people's anger and uprising, the riots as a consequence of the ongoing lies, the ongoing cover-up, the ongoing brutality, which is really the issue, of course. And it becomes more the issue when people make it really clear they won't tolerate that anymore, and that's, I guess, what peaceful protesters and angry, violent protesters and looters alike are, well, they're putting out that word. So I'm going to begin with a little music from Kevin Robinson from his album Light. And the name of this piece is Spanish Dream. Nope, it's called The Calling. And we will hear that, and then I'll be back. You can too. 427-3772. Thank you. And that was Kevin Robinson's Acoustic Light. And again, the name of that one, as I mentioned before, is The Calling. So maybe hearing more from him later. He's on the streets occasionally. I haven't seen him much. Well, I see him occasionally on the streets. So in the studio with me is Pat Malo. And I want to point just sort of a quick recap. He's cannabis activist for the last 12 years. Correct me if anything's wrong here, Pat, when I'm saying. You've been involved in local politics. You know. And we talked last time at some length about the supervisor's latest law that you are attempting to change with the referendum.
Yep.
And that's still going around. You'll find it at the farmer's market, presumably Safeways, movie theater lines, smokeouts. Not Safeways. Oh, dear.
The more aggressive about...
Oh, well, fuck them. Sorry, I don't mean to be so cruel of our Safeway people. Fuck them. Let me say it again. You went into some of the details about why this particular 10-by-10 restriction on marijuana growing, except for WHAM, by the Supes, was a bad idea. You pointed out that a second proposal that would have allowed four distributors or four growers in the county to distribute was ignored or defeated.
Yeah, it would allow 2 to 4 growers per dispensary.
That was defeated, so. But instead we have this 10-by-10 law, which will go into effect in a couple of weeks unless your referendum gets enough signatures, right?
It will go into effect in 12 days, but luckily I think we're doing pretty well.
Now, what's the impact if you get the required number of signatures of what, some 6,700?
7,500.
If you get those, that immediately freezes it for the moment?
It puts a freeze on the most recent ordinance and reverts back to what the ordinance was for the last year and a half, which was an imperfect ordinance that allowed for commercial cultivation in certain zones under certain circumstances, basically.
Okay, I want to apologize for our mic problems, but I think we're now maybe audible, more audible than we were before. My apologies to listeners. So again, Pat Malo, in case you didn't hear me say it before, because it probably sounded like I was across the room. Sorry about that. We've also talked about, I've badmouthed Valerie Corral of WHAM a bit because I felt she hasn't been a high enough profile either in defending marijuana distribution centers when they were banned from opening between 2000 and 2005. And then on this latest matter, but you pointed out she had come and spoken to the Board of Supervisors on the issue. And that's good to hear. I haven't actually gotten any more information on her. You compared the current law that was passed by it's not yet current, but the law that will be current unless the referendum turns it back, which you're hopeful it will,
yes.
With the previous law, which essentially limited grows to zoning certain agricultural zones, or what was that?
Yeah, it would be everyone is allowed a 10-by-10 per parcel, but then if you qualify, meet all the zoning guidelines, basically it was a lot to do with the size of your parcel. And it was a few, like, residential zoning was left out, but it was many, like, rural agriculture, res ag, timber production, special use.
And what that means in plain English, that meant how restricted were growers from, let's say, prior to this 2014 law that was in effect until, the new law was passed and still in effect until two weeks down the road from now.
Yeah. And so prior to the one that we're reverting back to, it was a 10-by-10 per member of your collective. So you could, in essence, have as big of a garden as you had members of your collective.
And that was prior to 2014.
Prior to 2014.
And then in 2014, how did that change?
2014, the County Board of Supervisors had been addressing a dispensary ordinance and addressing a cultivation ordinance, partially because it had had a moratorium on it on new dispensaries that they had been... It had been in effect for years and years and years, so it was a time that they had to relook at this because they'd been kicking it down the road so long, and they also wanted to get something into place that would kind of bring Santa Cruz up into where I think they thought it needed to be for the future with legalization, is this becoming more and more of a regular issue, I think.
So what in fact did they do that changed it from the prior 10, every individual on the 10 by 10 can have their own 10 by 10 amount, you know, parcel?
Yeah, so they changed it to, you can have one 10 by 10 no matter what, and then anything bigger than that qualifies as commercial cultivation, even though a lot of it wasn't commercial in the traditional sense. We've talked about non-commercial collectives and stuff.
And what impact did that have on growers over the last year?
Well, on growers over the last year, a lot of them, there was a lot of misunderstanding of this law.
And collectives
so,
as well.
So there was not, a lot of collectives thought they were secure in growing a certain amount because they thought they fit into the new ordinance with parcel size and setbacks and things like that. So they felt like they were allowed.
So that was the additional thing that was added, parcel. What was added in 2014 is what I'm asking.
Yeah, parcel size and a whole bunch of different kind of setbacks now allowed for different scales of cultivation. And I believe it was, you know, 3 acres, you could get a 1,000 or 3,000 square feet, and over 5, you could have up to, I think, 5,000 square feet. So not huge, but a substantial amount of square
and
feet.
All this was wiped out by the ordinance passed
and
by the Sioux several weeks ago.
By the ordinance.
Which said no grows at all except for WHAM or a 10 by 10 for an individual member of a collective.
Yeah, and that's correct. This is all okay. Wiped out.
And so, but you're attempting to deal with this, and how can people sign up if they're, you have to be a registered voter in the county, right?
Yeah, you have to be a registered voter in the county, but you can always re-register if you've moved from somewhere to, so if you're a current resident in the county, but you're not registered here, you can
Where can you actually sign up for this?
You can do it at a lot of the dispensaries are now having volunteers there. There's a list of where our volunteers will be on rcsantacruz.org, and you can go to the website and see specifically where gatherers will be. But they've been trying to hit a lot of the main events. They're always at the farmer's market. There's always someone wandering downtown. And
even in the heat.
Yeah, even in the heat, they're out there today.
So regarding dispensaries, I kind of assigned you some homework on Sunday. One was to go to each individual of the 14, I assume there are about 14 dispensaries in the county, maybe
yep.
more, and find out, you know, whether they have real low-income capability. And, you know, I didn't think, frankly, you'd be able to do it in 4 days. And also, I thought, even if you did get the official word, that wouldn't necessarily be the true word and yep. what actually happens when a low-income person walks in. But have you gotten any information that you think might be helpful for people?
Yeah, I mean, I talked with a WHAM member about how it works there. And, you know, even though you're critical at some level, I consider you a supporter of the ideal of WHAM, and that's why you're
Well, it's not
critical.
That I'm critical of that. I mean, I am, but it's not. WHAM is not a, they do sweat equity and you work there and, you know, I mean, it's a different setup than, let's say, other
yeah.
dispensaries where you walk in with a card and you buy it.
Yeah.
So that's what, have you had any information on any of those folks?
So, yeah, and those ones, I know that they all have some sort of compassion program. And those, what their compassion program is not necessarily always just a public statement. You know, that you'll go in and you'll get different treatment depending on how their compassion program is doing at the moment. So what I'm trying to say is it's not necessarily everyone who meets these criteria will be able to get served. It's they give away a certain amount.
How do you know this? Did you actually talk to them?
This is from just experience with the Kind People's Collective that I worked at, and I've talked to them even before this about this.
But you haven't gone through the particular
ones
individually.
I need to go in person and get an official answer, right? And then we
send
also
in, send
need
in a
to
ringer
have
to
someone
find out,
go
yeah.
in mm-hmm. who can see how it actually plays out on the ground,
in
so
practice,
to speak.
Yeah.
And so I've talked to some people about the project, and I'm going to be getting around to dispensaries for the initiative reason anyway. But it's a
if you find out more information, really curious to hear about
yeah,
it because that's what low income people need to know.
Yeah,
about,
and that's so. And that's really I see it as an important issue when we discuss what sort of laws that we should have about cannabis to really just to make sure that people who need it the very, very most are at least
for
brought
sure.
into this discussion.
And the other question...
And I feel like these specific laws, if you can point to ways that people who, you know, would be getting served now would be limited, you know, because there are... Like
right.
Said,
well, when you get more
know,
info, I want to hear yeah, about yeah. it. And I think also, you know, another question I raised at the last discussion we had on Sunday was, what's the actual output of marijuana in the county, and what are the needs? And that's, of course, a very difficult question to answer. Have you gotten any new information on that came up?
No, but at my next meeting, the person who is the one who at the County Board of Supervisors mentioned the $500 million industry mark, I can ask him, and we'll ask him.
Now, was there a meeting of the Cannabis Advocates Alliance on Wednesday?
Yeah, last night there was. I don't know why it wasn't on whatever
Indie Bay, yeah, Santa Cruz Indie Media.
Yeah, we do our best, but we're
still what came up
better.
At that meeting that we should know about?
Last night, we gave basically an update on where we were signature-wise with the referendum, and then we also gave updates about how the initiative planning was going. And basically, in short, is that we're about two-thirds or three-quarters of the way to our goal of 7,500 validated signatures. We've got like 5,000 something. We've got 13 more days, so we're hopeful that it's
meeting was
through.
Well attended.
Yeah, we fluctuate from maybe 30 to 50 or 60 people on the big nights, and I say last night was a smaller night with about 30 people fluctuating in. But we also have been doing it week in, week out, and we have a large. There's people who filter in, so it's not the same people over and over. There's hundreds of people that have passed through our meetings.
Now the other reason you came into the studio, and I'm pushing this along because I know you got to get to a meeting at 7.
Yep,
is that you are going to do a little research on the initiatives that are pending, that at least have been filed with the state for the 2016 election. Now, what I'm looking for you now is not an elaborate and extensive and detailed analysis, which you mentioned might be coming out later. You say there are actually six of them that may actually be contesting with each other, six different initiatives trying to decriminalize or legalize or, cause it more sane. Do the Colorado or Washington solution or better for cannabis, not just for medical marijuana people, but for everybody who wants to use it however they want to use it. But I've looked at a couple of the initiatives, at least descriptions of them, through what I thought was initially a pretty good website, and then I kind of changed my mind, Legalization Nation. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of a weekly column, if anybody's interested in looking at it. It's out of the East Bay Gazette, which is a sort of an advertising throwaway, which also has some interesting stories, as I've said here before. They have to catch the liberals' eye somewhere, so sort of like, you buy Playboy, I don't do it to look at the pictures, I do it because I'm reading the stories, you know. But Legalization Nation covered some of these issues very critically with a couple of the initiatives, suggesting that they were impossible to raise money for, that they'd never get anywhere, that they were too extreme, that the cities would oppose them. Give us a real quick summary of the initiatives. I'm not going to try to hold you to all the fine points. Yep. And give us what you think your choice would be at the moment.
Yeah, well, it's a great, what you said is totally true. A lot of the time when we talk about these things, people describe what is possible and not possible, and I think that a lot of the time they really underestimate what is possible. So that's my personal opinion, and we'll get to that, the initiative that I think best embodies what is actually possible in a second, but we'll just go through briefly the ones that have officially filed, and the first two are actually there's one of these that is different. It's a constitutional amendment. So the first one I'd like to talk about is the California Cannabis Coalition has put together a compassionate and sensible access act is what it's called. And that's a constitutional amendment that they're running that is one page long, really simple. And what it's meant to do is protect medical cannabis from state legalization. And what that does, it's a really simple one-page thing that says that the state laws and county jurisdictions can't infringe on the medical patients' rights and what is allowed by this already by the California medical system.
It sounds like something that is not really legalization for recreational, but it's sort of an additional
and that's why I want to mention it first, is this is something that, regardless of which one of these you support, this is one that we hope gets on the ballot with everything else, because it's not perfect and it doesn't guarantee protection for cannabis, because we can watch right now what's happening with the medical cannabis struggle and having rights rolled back, but it does at least attempt to preserve the core of 215.
You also say preserve against legalization. This implies that some of the other measures might imperil medical marijuana.
Yes, definitely. And like we've talked about over and over, is that there's, and just to get really big picture for a second, is for a long time the issue wasn't, it was simple. It was, do you want cannabis to be illegal or do you want something else? And everyone rallied behind that something else, anything but the way it's treated now, and we called that legalization. And now that we're actually there, we realize that legalization is there's many different kinds, and what we want now as cannabis activists is not legalization, but it's the right kind of legalization or regulation or whatever you want to call it. But unfortunately, we want to not just lift the restrictions on that have been on cannabis, but we also want to make sure that whatever new restrictions come in, that we don't suffer from them in the exact same way or similar ways that we suffered from the old cannabis laws. So I want to just make sure that we are going in the right direction.
So we have four bills or four proposed initiatives that are going to be coming up. Which, just to begin with, take the worst first. Now, which do you feel would imperil medical marijuana the most, and which, and again, I realize that you're kind of talking off the cuff, maybe.
Yeah. So the worst one in my mind hasn't been filed yet. It's with a group that's called Reform CA, and I don't want to come out and just say this is a bad bill and there's not wonderful people involved in this, but I feel like it's the most conservative and it's a lot of the people who are involved with Prop 19.
Rather than the name of the and I appreciate all that information there, but what is it that substantively it does that you don't like?
First,
or doesn't do that it should do?
So that one's hard to say because it hasn't come out yet, but when we were at their meeting, things like restricting personal gardens to 6 plants, or there was talk of even a 10x10 per person. And in Colorado, Washington, other places we've seen legalization, your ability to grow it is limited. And so this bill that hasn't been written yet, but we were at the meeting for, I think that would focus on the commercial end of things, in a sense, and limit people's personal ability to garden to something that's very small and restrictive.
Fair enough. What's up next after that?
The next one I don't like just because of the complexity of it, is there's a 40-page bill called, where do I have it here? Responsible Use Act that has been filed. People don't really know a lot about the people behind it, and that's not saying anything, but I feel like this one is just long and complex, has a lot to do with just the regulations on the commercial end of things, and I don't think does enough to protect normal people or medical in the big picture. Then there's two of them that are some things I like about, and some things I don't, and they're very similar, and they were, because maybe they had talked about merging for a while, but the first one filed was the California Craft Cannabis Initiative, and that one is nice in a sense because it sets a low bar. And when I say that the long 40-page one deals with the commercial end of it, it's a lot about the different fees and where the fees, how high the fees would be to, say, be a gardener or be a retailer and be this, and then also has to do with some of these have taxes allocated to certain places and things like that. And I'm not saying that doesn't need to be a part of it, but I think first with these things we need to preserve.
Now, what about the California Craft Cannabis Initiative?
So the California Craft Cannabis Initiative gets into these specifics of what kind of fees and what commercial actors would look like, but it sets aside a small. If you are under 99 plants, you are a craft cannabis producer, and that you, they local municipalities can limit you, like we talked about with the local ordinance of zoning, where you can't be, but they can't ban you outright, and the ability to pay for the I think the license is capped at $1,000. Or something, and so that one is something that's nice. But then we get into it, and it gets a little more into what the bigger people would look like, and then limits the small end of personal production.
So let's take this call, and don't lose your place, though.
Yep.
Let's see what we got here. Hi there, you're on Free Radio with Pat and Robert.
Am I on the radio, huh?
You are on the radio.
Well, I just wanted to do a call out about what we're going to be protesting for the May 1st.
Oh, please.
What House is going to be there for.
Okay.
So I'm looking at my notes, and one of the things is house keys, not handcuffed, homes, not jail, and then also injury to one is an injury to all. These are things that Becky Johnson brought up. So that's kind of our stop SCPD from selective enforcement against homeless. And then we were also saying, we were supportive of what's going on in Baltimore, where people are standing up because they've had enough with all the bad apples in the police department killing people.
Okay, I guess this is happening tomorrow at the town clock at 4:15 or so?
4:30 is when it's the May Day is happening, but Huff is going to be there with Cafe Huff at 4 o'clock. I wrote down 3, but I know it was 4.
Mm-hmm.
We're also going to be doing a protest on, I think we decided next Tuesday at 3. At the Homeless Service Center.
Right. I guess there's a plot afoot to, and I just got a response from Marlon Granlund, the head of the planning department, Public Works, and he's the parking guy. I don't know if he's the head of Public Works, but he's one of the people there, and he said that they are planning to modify the permit parking situation that's already in effect on Coral Street and two other nearby streets. And he sent me, I think I sent it to you, caller, but I think he didn't clarify what kind of modification was going to be made, so I made that request to find out more.
Correct.
I think
yes,
we're trying
I
to find
that
out.
Last night.
Yeah, we're trying to find out, if this requires, and apparently they send out postcards that say, vote yes or no on this, or object to it if you want. If there's enough objection, it goes to the Transportation and Public Works Commission for a hearing. Even though I think it's already, I may be misstating this, but as I understand it, it's already, there already is permit parking out there. That's already passed. But I think to make a change, they have to still get 67% approval.
Like they did for the Circle Church.
However, the 67% approval doesn't mean they have to get 67% people
of the area or the people sending them postcards saying yes. They just have to get no votes or very few no votes. And at least that's...
No.
So it sounds like it's a little rigged in advance, although I got to be honest, and I don't want to be unfair to the Public Works Department, I was a little confused about their explanation because this process is different than that which was used at the Circle Church. That's the other...
Right, it's very different.
And the reason the process is different is apparently it's a modification of an existing permit parking that's already been put into place. And so I don't have details, but that's, I think, going to be one of the main focuses that we're going to have, or foci, if you're a mathematician.
Remember what we brought up at our meeting?
I'm sorry?
Would you like me to refresh your memory on one of the things we discussed?
Sure, but before you do, I'll just say
anyone who ever wants to come, those are on Wednesday at 11 at the Rosa.
Right, but before you refresh my memory, I'll just mention that the Homeless Lack of Services Center, or 115 Coral Street, as I call it, or the Homeless Services Center, as they call themselves, is now a gated area with a locked gate that you have to get in through, through sort of an entranceway where you get escorted around unless you have an ID card. There are security guards on the grounds. Police can be found there. It has become, according to some homeless people, and others don't agree, some people like it, some don't, more prison-like.
Oh, you know what? I have to call you right back. I have a police call.
All righty. Give me a call right back. Thanks for calling, Pat. And I'll see you tomorrow at the town clock and maybe on Tuesday, definitely on Tuesday, in front of the Homeless Service Center, or lack thereof. So, that we're going to be having interruptions because we do take on-the-air calls on other subjects as they come up.
I love interruptions.
Oh, good, good. Well, you're going to get them, Pat, that's for sure. That was another Pat. That was Pat Colby calling in, or Pushback Pat, as I've called her, among other things.
I also love other Pats, so...
Okay, well, you two should get together. You could pat each other, perhaps. I don't know. The other thing about this protest coming up on Tuesday, it's an information gathering session. We want to find out how people are feeling out there about the security gate, the locked situation, the lack of lockers, the services that do exist. Are people getting into the Paul Lee Loft? Are they getting access to how are the meals? How are they being treated? If they want to sign up for the waiting list, which is supposed to immunize them from sleeping tickets, or at least get their sleeping tickets dismissed. Is that happening? Is that working? Are they getting evidence that they're on the waiting list that they can show to the police? We found that's often not the case in the past. So we're looking for a variety of things. Plus, and this is the new thing that we're thinking of doing on that day, if it does require for this change in the permit parking, for there to be no negative votes or very few negative votes, are the 115 Coral Street residents authorized to write in and say, we do not want to see these additional restrictions on parking there? And again, I don't know what the restrictions are, so I can't talk about them intelligently until Marlon Granlin or one of his subordinates gets back to me. So far, I've made 3 phone calls to Public Works over the last 2 days. Marlon has been prompt in getting back to me, but not with the very specific information about what the changes are. So I will hope to find that and have that information passed on to you. But do go to the protests. That includes you, Pat, if you get bored. You can bring your marijuana, referendum signature gathering there. That's going to be tomorrow at the town clock at 4:15, 4:30, and Tuesday in front of that 115 Coral Street. And that's going to be at 3 o'clock. So. But you were talking before, and we were discussing the California Craft Cannabis Initiative. We're talking about there are 5 initiatives, I guess, and 1 constitutional amendment that'll be changing the whole issue of legalizing marijuana for recreational use.
Yeah. So we were talking about the California Craft Cannabis Initiative, and I was saying that the nice thing about this one is it has a specific, it talks about the small cottage industry and has some protections for that, and that's why it's called the Craft Cannabis Initiative. Other than that, it sets up a commission that will shape most of the real regulations. And what I don't like about that is that a commission is more selective and can be influenced more than principles or guidelines. What I want with my initiative is something that sets hard thresholds where we can't drop below. A right to cultivate, a right to be non-commercial producers and protect the medical system that we still have.
You're big into the medical protection. What about the recreational users? Do you have any interest in protecting them? And if so, what do you suggest?
I think they should have the same, you know, and I think that the line between, you know, what you call medicine and recreational is semantics first and foremost. I feel like this is a natural herb that can be used to, in you know, better your standard of life in many ways. And if that's just smoking some to feel good at the end of your day, then that's one way to better your life. Or curing yourself from life-threatening diseases is another way to better your life. So I feel like, regardless whether it's medical or recreational, that cannabis is a good thing that needs to be encouraged first and foremost. I feel that
I catch all the theoretical stuff, but what about the specific ordinances? How do they differ in how they treat recreational marijuana? Have you looked at that?
So this one, the Craft Cannabis Initiative will set up a commission, and it'll protect small players in that. They're all 21 and up, from my understanding. And so it leaves a lot up to the commission and then the municipalities that they're going to institute
Does it decriminalize cannabis use?
No. In fact, the first one that I would... And this is one of the major issues that we're getting to, is that some of these, like the... I know for sure the California, what is the Responsible Use Act, still has sale of cannabis being a $2,500 fine and up to 1 year in prison. So it does not completely legalize or decriminalize. And this is one of the things that we see happening in a lot of these, is that people want to keep the, you know, prohibition level profits, but they want to steer those into, you know, government and large businesses. And then they also want to be able to keep the prohibition style policing. And so that we're going to see.
Why? What's the motivation?
I mean, because first and foremost is that there's so much vested interest in policing the way that it's done now. I mean,
forfeitures and stuff.
Yeah, well, and just the drug war has been the main tool of law enforcement to fill the jails, which is profitable now, not just for, there's big for-profit prison systems that rely on this. There's also huge amounts of people who work in the industry, like we always hear about the prison guard lobby, and then we also have law enforcement who has frankly gotten used to a certain kind of policing, and it's hard to get them back if there ever was a day we want to go back to. But they have definitely become used to it, what I would call like a drug war mentality on top. So I think that there's profit, and then there's a lot of belief that's backing this up.
Rather than have you contrast these different approaches, which I want to see, you're talking about working with friends or having friends or people you know put together a kind of a spreadsheet matrix that really contrasts each of these. Does this decriminalize? How much is a sale? How about transportation? And that would be something. Because when we try to talk about it, I don't think people who aren't sitting down with this in front of them can really follow it. But what they can follow is, at this point, is anything being circulated?
I do not believe things are being circulated that I've seen, but I could be mistaken. I think that maybe some of these that have been filed already are being. But what we're also seeing, and what I wanted to understand what's happening here, is that this is the first. You won't see all of these on the ballot, and probably a lot of these are going to merge into one another. As we see, there's some other actors in this whole thing, big organizations like DPA, MPP, and Weed Maps, a big cannabis website, basically. And then there's also a Blue Ribbon Commission on Cannabis with Gavin Newsom. And then some local, Ben Rice locally is involved with that. Alan Hopper, who I think lives in town, ACLU lawyer, who's been involved in the local politics, is on the Blue Ribbon Commission. And where these other players come in and which of these initiatives that they back will cause some other ones to back out.
So for listeners right now, there's nothing being circulated because I guess the Attorney General has not yet clarified a statement for the for the ballot. So in a way, we're kind of we're jumping the gun, you know. And I'm going to kind of jump back to stuff we were talking about on Sunday, which is, you know, the real issue. You didn't get into politics or into even organizing for these kinds of political measures for years because you were, I think, properly cynical about the impact of this. You were, you've been working with punk rock band.
I've been involved in, I've been a cannabis activist for and involved in the movement, but I have not been out in front in out in the open. You know, I've been involved in supplying medicine to people who need it and directly.
Illegally?
Quasi-legally, you know?
Right.
And definitely it's been a reward system that works out for the people that need it.
See, the question
in my case, and then also getting it. But I asked myself just last night after Cannabis Advocates Alliance when I was standing up taking heat for potential laws that hadn't been passed yet being too restrictive, and I thought to myself, why am I even part of this, you know, this process of making laws that then will be used against me at some level? And my only answer is that I'm more afraid of not being there at the table.
And I don't know if that's a good thing. I think it's probably not a good thing, but I understand the feeling.
Yep.
Because what I'm thinking here is, what kind of advice can we give to activists in Santa Cruz for the next year? For people who are being dragged off to jail, for people who are, who need medicine and can't afford it, for people who are getting crappy deals at dispensaries, for people who want to grow and don't have all the equipment to grow. I guess these are really issues that, you know, have to be addressed, I suppose, individually.
Yeah.
But I think I would like to encourage people, although, you know, sign these initiatives if you want. And even, you know, walk around with a clipboard and sign people up for these initiatives. But the idea of putting one's faith and trust in these kinds of groups is just completely, I think, asked backwards.
I mean, if you're putting faith and trust in the political system to do anything but work against you as a normal person, I think you're just not being realistic. And then we ask why participate at all, which is a realistic question. And I feel like if you're participating and you don't have faith that this is all that you're doing, then that's okay. And what I'm trying to say is that I think for a lot of this stuff, people just need to plain take matters into their own hands.
And if they need to garden, they need to garden. And how can we advise and help people in that? And on this radio station is going to be a question, but I think we have a caller here. Hi there, you're on Free Radio with Pat and Robert, and I bet this is the other Pat. Hello.
The other Pat. Hi.
Hey, the other Pat. So,
Who's the other Pat?
I can be the other Pat if that's more comfortable
everyone. It's Pat and Pat, folks. We've got Pat in the studio.
Oh, okay.
You haven't been listening to the show.
You're a family.
You haven't been listening to the show, I take it, Pat.
No, I haven't been able to.
Yeah, well, the person in the studio is Pat Malo, who's been circulating a cannabis petition to overturn the Board of Supervisors' essentially smash down of cultivators in the county. So, but what we talked about before was the two protests coming up, one tomorrow and one on Tuesday. And I kind of covered that. Or is there more you think you want to say on that?
I didn't know in particular what you call them, the May Day protest, May 1st.
Right, that's
what
tomorrow.
What exactly is the whole theme of that for your listeners?
Well, you know, you say you want to talk some more about that? I don't know. I mean,
your listeners know what it's about.
Well, I think, first of all, most people listening to the station probably know what May Day protests are generally about, which, of course, is Workers' Day, Women's Day. IWW has been, you know, free speech fights and of course, the rights of folks across the world, mostly around, I guess, working conditions and so forth, and the right to... That's also to do with, you know, equity of wealth and the right to, you know, basic rights in society. But for us, you know, for us and Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, which I think you're going to talk about, it has to do with the right for not to be treated like a class of pariahs, not to be treated in
or
a criminal.
Rodents.
Yeah, or
signs being put up.
Exactly. Like, not to be actually criminalized. And we've, you know, this show has gone into great detail about the kinds of criminalization that happens: sleeping bans, sitting bans, bans on being a curfew bans at night, of even just sitting down on a bench in various areas of town, even if you're doing nothing. Median bans. You can't hold up a sign on the medians around.
And they've been removing benches, so they have nowhere to sit.
So the issue, you know, and I guess for a lot of people, for me, is, you know, I think it's good to raise these issues, and I guess Huff will be raising his issues tomorrow. You'll be there, I guess, scooping out coffee and
coffee.
You'll be, you know, loading people up with coffee and getting them all awake so they can perhaps violate or not violate the sleeping ban at 11 o'clock at night.
My infamous brownies.
So what else you got to say about that? I only have about 9 minutes left or less with our man, this other Pat, in the studio because he's got to run. So do you have any other thoughts?
Do you want me to call back and we can discuss this later?
Why don't you summarize it now and then we can decide if we need to talk more.
What I wanted to say is it's not just all these laws that are violating homeless and poor people's civil rights, but I'm onto the trail as I talk to more and more people that there's also rogue officers, possibly, and rogue citizens that are going out into the woods finding these homeless, and they're beating them up. And also, I just got a tip, which I don't know if it's credible yet, but I'm going to be starting to talk to people and document it about homeless men that are drunk, and they wake up and they're being sexually assaulted by these people that are going in the deep woods after them. So they're not just being abused by the police, but they're being criminal acts, violations, assaults done on them.
Mm-hmm. Sounds kinky to me. In any case,
yeah. So, and they're really vulnerable, and of course, the police aren't.
Well, you know, about 15 years ago, when the Homeless Issues Task Force was doing its actually good, it was doing some useful research. That what it really was is a diversion from any real changes. And we had a majority on the city council briefly, but there was a lot of documentation of massive assaults on homeless people, not sexual assaults, but kind of skinhead type beatings. Aaron Birch was a leader of, or at least one of the people convicted of doing that back in 1999. And there was the police chief himself actually admitted that homeless people were 4 to 10 times more likely to be assaulted than folks who were housed. And yeah, so that's a real issue. I'm always wary of anonymous reports or exaggerations because they don't help us.
I've been given some leads that did lead me to the paintball shooter.
I'm sorry?
So I was able to identify a like car with a like description.
I don't think anybody knows what you're talking about, Pat. And let me suggest if you want to call back on this. And I'm not saying, you know, it isn't worth calling back on. Let me conclude here, though, with the other.
Yeah, part. Let's do that. I'll call back.
And you can call back if you want. Bye-bye. So, paintball shooter. Yeah, we'll go back to that. That actually was an account I got from a second person that people were throwing, frozen rocks or ice at homeless people along River Street before the River Street closed down for the repairs that it's now. It's now been blocked off on the way up to Felton. Anyway, Pat.
So to sum up, I think what things are, because we've talked about some of the problems with some of the other ones and didn't really get into it to the full extent, but something that the one that hasn't been filed, but I support most, would be the California Cannabis Hemp Initiative, and that's the Jack Hare bill. And for those who don't know, Jack Hare was a not just a variety of cannabis, but a real person who was a real activist and probably one of the most outspoken, civil liberties and cannabis activists we know. So this bill, actually, we talked about what is cannabis still going to be criminalized under some of the other ones. And the cannabis, the CCHI bill I'm talking about, would let everyone for out of jail for non-violent cannabis offenses. The other bills wouldn't necessarily do that. It also lets every citizen, normal person, non-medical patient, have up to 99 plants and 12 pounds of dried cannabis, which is much more realistic about how people should be able to go about using this herbal remedy at home. You know, we should encourage people to grow as much of their cannabis supply personally as we possibly can, just like we encourage people to grow
their own food. Why would you restrict it at all? Why would you want to restrict it at all? Why would you want to restrict the amount of cannabis? Somebody wants to grow lots and lots of cannabis. Somebody wants to grow lots and lots of tomatoes. I mean, why is there a problem there?
Yeah, I don't think that there's any problem.
Then why would we support something that restricts it?
Just because of the political climate that when Jack and everyone came up with this, this was a representation of what they thought pushed the envelope of what is possible. And I'm not saying that we couldn't write something that pushes the envelope of much more of what's possible than this, but I think that
it's not so much what's possible. I'm thinking more at what's sensible and what's correct and what's in line with what is done with other agricultural products. Pandering to paranoia about cannabis at all always bothers me. And also, the same arguments that you may be using, although maybe you're not, to say, well, you know, you got to take to some extent what's possible, is going to be used to defeat this measure.
Yeah.
They're going to say, this is not possible. Instead, you need to, first of all, get millions of dollars from George Sorrell or the Proposition 19 folks.
Yep.
And therefore, you're not going to be able to go anywhere with that. What's your thought on that argument?
Well, I think that is definitely, unfortunately, the reality of things is that in order to get the financial support from people, they are going to either need to believe that what you're doing doesn't threaten their interests and is winnable. And so first the first part of that's a financial thing. So a lot of the times these initiatives will make concessions to people that will, because it'll benefit them financially. I think we saw that with Prop 19 and Richard Lee, because he knew he had the political infrastructure in Oakland to be able to grow a lot. He backed Prop 19, and you know, it's those sort of conflicts of interest are hard to get around. And then also, I think that most people are just ideologically are trained from the drug war to think that a lot of the drug war logic is actually true, and this stuff is actually
dangerous. You want to pander to that fear? Do you want to pander to that misconception?
No, and I don't.
And I don't either. Regarding Lee, though, I mean, yeah, that's a Oaksterdam guy up in a large marijuana wholesaler or a retailer. I guess he's still in business up there.
The businesses that he helped get going are definitely still there. He's still active in the cannabis community.
And there was a lot of concern that there was a concern. Oh, unless you cut back stuff and be more moderate, you're not going to win. Because of the drug war hysteria, because of whatever training people have. I don't know if he used that argument or his supporters used that argument in the Proposition 19, the one that attempted and failed in 2010 in California. But there was also the other side of which said a lot of people who are in the medical marijuana movement backed away from supporting 2010. Do you have any sense of the numbers there at all? Would it have been true that had the measure been more protective of medical marijuana and maybe even more expansive, it would have garnered more votes or would have lost more votes?
I think that's hard to say. If it was more expansive, were the cannabis supporters who voted against it more than 4%? Because I think it lost by 4% or something. And I can't say that they are. I think that the CCHI, what I just read, which is much, obviously still panders to kind of drug war hysteria in a sense, but it's much, much, much more lax, so to speak, compared to the other
ones. Liberal, not lax.
Yeah,
please.
Liberal,
right.
But it's still, this one polled, the CCHI in 2014 polled at 56%. So I think that naturally
the Harar Initiative, CCHI, the one you're talking about, the one you support, and the one that, lets people out of jail who are nonviolent marijuana offenders, was also being proposed back in 2010, I believe.
Yeah.
It couldn't make the ballot, right?
Yeah, it's been, a document for a long time. There's been little changes to it, but it's been consistently run by there's a group of dedicated activists that have been pushing for this for a long time, and it's Jack's bill, so it has special significance.
Now you have $5 million behind you to put that on the ballot.
I believe that there's been a lot of talk of certain people who had donated and pledged this and that, and it's hard for me to keep up on. I'm not directly involved in this.
We can talk more about this, you know, as time goes on. I guess the deadline for getting these initiatives on the ballot is when?
I don't know that. I should know that.
You better find out. And we do want, of course, a full listing of the costs for low-income marijuana in all 14 dispensaries around the county.
And I will get that project done. I think that the best, I'll let you know when I have substantial, you know, a little presentation for you.
Don't call me, I'll call you. Sort of thing.
It doesn't have to be that way. I was just trying to be polite.
No,
you can call. Feel free to call and harass and check in as much as you need to. You know,
watch what you say. You may get what you want if you don't.
And hopefully, I'll make it down on Wednesday for the next Huff meeting, and then tomorrow, if I can, down with some signature gatherers at the clock tower at 2:00. Is that the
tomorrow at 4:15?
4:15.
And then Tuesday it's going to be at the Homeless Lack of Service Center, where you actually can sign up voters there probably, and they might be interested in this as well.
Yeah. Well, and just in a, I got to run, but in a closing remark, I think that if we have to say it again, everything that's happening in Baltimore and stuff shines a light on we need to take every tool out of law enforcement's toolbox to be used against us. And I think that ending cannabis prohibition, if it's just at a state level and if it's not perfect, is still a step towards taking those tools away, even if it's just symbolically. And
we've been talking with Pat Malo, who can be reached at how?
You can, anything that you need to send to me, I would say you could go to the rcsc.org, and there's email there, pat@rcsc.org, I think is the best way for people to get a hold of me if they want to, or come down. I'm at the Cannabis Advocates Alliance meetings almost every single Wednesday, 7:00 to 9:00.
Loudon Nelson Center.
Even if we forget to put it on the indie posting.
Indeed. Well, I'm glad you came in, Pat, and good luck at your meeting, whatever you're doing.
Yep, and thanks again, and I'm blessed to be down here with you talking, and I'll keep talking as much as you'll have me.
Hey, we'll have you again. Call in if you've got any thoughts, comments on what Pat's been saying. We'll pass on stuff to him. He's got to leave, but if you have questions, I will let him know that you did have questions. You can also, of course, reach him at the email address, pat@rcsc.org.
Bye. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Pat.
Bye. I'll talk
to you soon. No problem. All right. Let's go musical, and I'll be right back. That was Skidmark Bob from 2 decades ago. Down so fucking long, it looks like up to me. And Mumia doesn't have to be executed. He's apparently going to be killed through medical neglect and being cut off from doctors in jail. That's been a source of a lot of concern to people concerned about Mumia Abu-Jamal, and I haven't got any updates on that at the moment, but it's... It was mentioned on a couple of shows in the last week, a couple of mainstream or alternate mainstream shows like Democracy Now. It looks like we may not be getting a call in from Baltimore. Earlier today, I spoke with Vanessa of... I don't think it's called Voices from the Streets, but it's a street newspaper in Baltimore run by homeless folks, or at least... with homeless folks involved in it. I wanted to get some sense of how the Baltimore police are treating poor people there and what the impact is of the increased militarization on the streets with the uprising people against the institutionalized murder that apparently happens in a number of cities and then gets covered up. Murder, how can I say that? Why is Freddie Gray's death a murder without, you know, a trial and so forth? That's true. The officers who I suspect killed him are not yet even indicted. They aren't even fired from the police force, and we don't even know who they are. So we can't tell what their history, their background, their record on the streets are. You know, after an individual gets killed by police or brutalized by the police, and if it's publicized, usually there's an immediate outpouring from the police department of that individual's criminal record and what a bad woman or man she or he was. And so, of course, with the police department, they guard closely the identities of these people. Here in Salinas, I should say nearby Salinas, that was the case until activists forced the police chief, or, you know, effectively pressured him into revealing the names of the officers who killed at least one or two of the five people who were shot by Salinas police in the last year and a half. But that isn't happening right now, so maybe on Sunday we'll get lucky, or get luckier. I did get to a benefit, as I mentioned before, for the Highway 6. Those are activists who have been... who actually took the chance of blocking the freeway about a month ago and were promptly criminalized for it. I mean, they were, you know, technically they were engaging in crime. What they're trying to do is, you know, help the community and the state to wake up to, well, their students. They're concerned about the massive tuition increases that are going on. But also... the obliviousness of police departments across the country, the resistance of police departments and other authorities to the growing exposure of police violence of an institutionalized sort, particularly against black people. It happens against everybody, of course, but it also most specifically and frequently, in terms of the percentage of population, happens against minority populations, particularly and specifically black people. And so I'm going to play a little of the conversations I had at that get-together. And we'll see how that goes. If I can find it, that is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's see what we got here. I think this is... Let's begin here. I'm here at the here at India Joe's, where there's a benefit for the Highway 6, the UCSC students and others who, I'm not quite sure if they're all students, who blocked the highway or are accused. And people continue to file in and out, and there's still some tasty-looking food here. So tell me when you'll be able to...
guitar.
So I'm talking with a man who has several buttons on his shirt. I support the Highway 6, slugs against the First Amendment suppression, drop the Highway 6 charges, stop political repression at UCSC, free the Highway 6. Who am I talking to?
Well, you're just talking to Casual Observer.
And Casual Observer, you are a person who's been active in this movement for a while.
Yeah.
And what are the issues that the community should be aware of around why students are risking jail and suspension and not getting suspended? Why do you think they're doing that?
Well, people have been aware of the fact that the University of California is becoming increasingly more and more expensive, and tuition hikes keep happening despite all of this student resistance all the time. In 2009, for example, students were protesting like crazy when the economy crashed and the university all of a sudden couldn't find enough money, and they raised tuition by a whopping 30%.
What is tuition now?
So tuition right now is like $30,000, and there's a proposed 27% increase on that, and that would hike what I pay up to around $35,000, and it's even more for out-of-state students.
Now, apologists say, for the university, say that, wait, but half the students are there on some kind of benefit, or they get some kind of grant. This is only true for half the upper half of the student body, but is the wealthier half. What's your response for that?
Well, I know students who are on financial aid who, have full rides, but, you know, that's not the majority of my friends, at least. And the other thing is that a lot of students who have financial aid, it's financial aid in the form of subsidized loans and financial aid in the form of Pell Grants, which actually took, you know, a lot, half of them are on Pell Grants because it's so expensive that nobody can afford it, so then they have to get Pell Grants and be able to go.
What is a Pell Grant?
So a Pell Grant is like a federally, doled out, you know, kind of, it's just a financial aid kind of support, but they cut it by $100 billion, something ridiculous. You can look up the exact numbers, but they cut it by like a ton. And they actually cut it, that was less than what they were proposing to cut it. So even though half the students are on some kind of financial aid keeps getting cut back and cut back, and tuition keeps getting raised up.
We've been talking with an observer. How can people get more involved?
So, yeah, I would say that people are very angry about these tuition hikes and angry at the fact that the university is more and more privatized. So people can just take to the streets and start spreading the word. And
blocking the freeways, perhaps?
Well, that's not necessarily advisable, but in certain cases, students have chosen to do that.
Yeah. So, but is there a website they can go on to get more information from?
Yes, there is.
And what is that website?
It's a for the six students. It's a GoFundMe website, and it says support the UCSC 6. Yeah.
And I may have to talk to one of these six people one of these days to find out what's going on.
Yeah, that would be a good idea.
Well, thank you, Observer.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So yeah,
but I want to say things you don't agree with. No problem. I'm talking with Brent Adams here, who actually on Monday night, I think it was, went to the police department's community room where Susie O'Hara, a city staff member, was presenting all the accomplishments of the Downtown Accountability Project, which I've, of course, been in severe disagreement with. But Brent, you were there. Give us an account of what you saw and what you thought.
There was a partnership between the new DA, I think his name is Jeff Rozelle, and Susie O'Hara, who works with the city, but she's administering the DAP program for the city-county collaboration.
Paid for it.
Yeah. And so what I have to say about it is I have my own opinions around what's necessary and needed with the population experiencing homelessness. The DAP program is meant to parse out drug addiction, mental health, and then people who need housing. And but what that's what it says it's doing, but what it's really doing is focusing on
problem people downtown.
Well, yeah, it's going through the motions, and I take them at their word, because if you're the district attorney and you're the city, when I say I'm taking them at their word, they don't actually have the real tools necessary to heal and help this population. So they only do it with the tools that they have, which are the judicial system, the courts. So we have the special judge. We have a special outreach worker, but they didn't open up. They acknowledge fully during their presentation, we haven't. Nothing has been done for the population experiencing homelessness and drug addiction or mental health challenges. They're mostly focusing on the population experiencing homelessness committing crimes, and that's really where this is at. So we have to really see it for what it is.
What crimes are they referring to? Did they specify?
Yeah, yeah. For the most part, these are alcohol crimes. These are possession crimes. Some violent crimes, very few. They in their data, they showed zero references to sleeping or
infraction
or any pee poo, anything like that. Any of the general things that we know that the law enforcement and the judicial system is focusing on homelessness. They said we're taking that out. This is not about homelessness. This is about. But they didn't say people experiencing homelessness committing crimes. So they're trying to, what they're really trying to do is focus in on the few committing those crimes. And by that token, I think it's an important tool. For the community at large, feeling lost, feeling disempowered around the fact that there's a small portion of people making it bad for everyone else. So if we still don't see anybody really helping a large part of that population, and that's what we really want to see. That's what I want to see. So I just want to tell them that they're fucked up if they're not, but they're doing what they can do with the tools that they have. So I acknowledge that, and I think it's...
What exactly are they doing is my question.
They're focusing on the people who are getting most of the tickets.
But having focus, what do they then do with their focus?
So they're realizing that this person is a homeless person, and they have caseworker programs that they're trying to make sure that they can get into, and it's an understanding that there's a revolving door for this population. So it's a little more aware, a little more awareness than before. Hi.
Well, I guess the question I really have.
Wait, there's somebody stepped in. So is this supposed to wait?
We'll pause this. So I've gotten some interesting thoughts from an attorney around the issue of the public nuisance charge and how it can be used and has been used against activists to essentially demand restitution. And at some point, I may get this attorney to talk to me in more detail.
And that was me at the India Joe's event. Benefit for the Highway 6, who are facing multiple misdemeanor charges, as well as in court, as well as they were facing suspension hearings, I believe, the next day. They had some yesterday and today. In fact, I'm going to give a call to Steve Plaich, who often has his ear to the ground on these kinds of issues, and also came from an ACLU meeting this Monday, I believe, a local ACLU. See if he has anything new to tell us. If we can reach him, of course, which is always problematic here on the air. And I believe I did get a few comments from him on Monday, but that was 3 days ago. And a lot of this, there's been a lot of action since then. Looks like we're not going to be
able to reach
him.
Your call has been forwarded to an automatic voice message system.
We might get lucky. Never can tell.
Is not available. At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Hey, Steve, this is Free Radio calling in. It's about 7:20, and I'd like to know if you've got any updates on the Highway 6 and the suspension hearings that happened. What happened at the ACLU Monday meeting, if anything, if you think that bears discussion, and anything coming up over the weekend You can give a call, 427-3772. So regarding the comments that Brent had about the Downtown Accountability Project meeting he went to, I find myself disagreeing with Brent, as I often do. For instance, the notion that the Jeff Rizal, the district attorney, who's part of this whole campaign to require $19,000 restitution from the students blocking the highway as a kind of a form of blackmail and extortion before they can be reduced, you know, let off of charges that were fundamentally a... It was a peaceful protest. It was the kind of thing that's happened time and time again with different protests. This time, however, they're punishing protesters as harshly as they can, showing you the kind of historical period we're in, really. And this nice guy, Jeff Rosell, who wants to heal the homeless, is a real heel around at least Highway 6, and also actually against Brent Adams himself. Brent is a member of the Santa Cruz 11, and now the Santa Cruz 4, who will be going to trial in August. I guess it may start in July, along with three other people. And I got no sympathy for these authorities and what they're doing, and I don't think we should sugarcoat it. And I don't think we should attempt to look at it in a positive light unless there's actually something really positive we can see. Now, the Downtown Accountability Project, I've sent emails to Susie O'Hara, who is the staff person, to find out exactly, get the names of the people who are supposedly benefiting from this program and find out what's really going on with them, if they want to talk to us. And she refuses to do that, claiming it's confidential. And when I ask for the court, she says, go talk to the courts. And I say, well, give me your court connection. And she says, well, the only court connection we had was a judge, Deneen Guy, which is, I suppose, I'm not saying she's necessarily lying about that. But this is the Downtown Accountability Project. I guess I'm going to have to look at their minutes to see exactly what happened. And that requires Public Records Act and back and forth emails. It may take some time. But the idea that the Jeff Rizal is trying to heal a situation rather than to essentially do the dirty work for the Downtown Association and remove people from the downtown who businesses regard as a pain in the ass and remove them by essentially giving them alternatives, go into this, quote, program or else go to jail. And you might say, well, I mean, isn't that what they're doing anyway? And the answer is sure. But the issue of whether there are real programs that actually are effective against for folks is not really addressed here and hasn't been addressed in, even when this program was formed. It was one of these the squealing wah, wah, wah responses of the city council to the Take Back Santa Cruz crowd and mentality, it seemed like to me, you know, the Comstock, Matthews, Bryant, Chereza's, Robinson clique on city council, majority, you might even say, that wanted to criminalize homeless people and blame them as an attempt essentially to blame them for problems, exaggerate and emphasize, exaggerate and I guess a caricature is really the word I'm looking for. I'm looking for something else. This is a gentrification activity where a certain group of property owners and those who support them want to run homeless people out of the area because it their property values go down. Their businesses are affected, they feel, or they might be, or they're afraid they might be, or they're not as comfortable as they might be. But in terms of actual criminal behavior, where we're talking about real crimes, I don't mean drunk in public, and I don't mean sleeping at night, and I don't mean really petty theft even. I mean, talking about real crimes, assault, things that really put the community in peril. I mean, petty theft is a pain in the ass, and I don't want anything of mine stolen. And I'm not really trying to defend petty theft, but I'm also noting that people who are poor, well, you know, historically they'll steal, and they'll even loot, as you see in Baltimore. And is this wrong? Well, it depends on how poor you are. It depends on how hungry you are. It depends on how pissed you are about how you've been treated over the last two or three decades and how your family has been treated and your relatives and your community is treated. A lot of these are, you know, the real considerations. So the idea that you want to remove a whole bunch of people from the area, and the way one of the ways you do that is you you create a project which appears to be, you know, it's masked as a help project, and that's what Brent Adams is suggesting that it is. And that's what they say it is. I'm trying to find out how many people have actually been helped in the sense of what kind of accommodations have been available for them and so forth. And I'm getting some answers, but I'm not getting a clear enough picture to really feel that's the case. And it just seems, and maybe my mind is stuck in some ruts, it's possible. It just seems that the same kind of thing that I've seen in other cities, the same kind of stuff that's used to justify the hosts and the security guards, which is essentially, they're mainly concerned with running people off who don't look right, according to the aesthetics of the merchants, the aesthetics of the conservative property owners. They want to create a different kind of community than exists here and make the prior community feel unwelcome so they can change the entire scene and create something which some of us regard as more sterile, more of a police state area, more of a really constrained area where there's a whole conservative mentality. And that is something I don't want to see in Santa Cruz. And I'm, you know, I've been speaking out against it for decades. So along with this is the bad apple theory. This came up at our Huff meeting yesterday, upsetting one of our Huff members a lot, because various Huff members, people have internalized this idea that, oh, the reason we have bad laws is because there are a couple of bad apples. No, the reason that they're, you know, in a police department, it's only a couple of bad apples. Actually, these are different arguments. So, but it's not the bad apples that are creating the laws around the criminalization of homeless people. It is a broader desire not to see poor people around. It really is. It is a broader desire to cleanse the area visually of those folks. It is not based upon real security concerns or real health concerns, but it is based instead upon a kind of an aesthetic. It's based upon, it's also based upon a redevelopment desire to upgrade the area and sell your property for more money. And it's also based upon the notion that everyone should behave like upper middle class people in public, even if they're hungry, even if they didn't get any sleep that night, even if they are suffering from numerous disabilities and they have no place to be. They are, i.e., without housing. And lots of excuses are created to justify cracking down on folks. And one of the most, some of the most nasty and slippery ones have to do with putting them in categories where you're saying, well, there's all kinds of different homeless people. There's the mentally ill homeless people, and there's the homeless by choice, and then there's the homeless who are drug addicts, you know, and then there's the alcoholic homeless. And there's the homeless who live here, and the homeless who just pass through town. And we have to consider each of these groups separately. And the actual reality is all these folks are possessed of one basic reality. They are, as I would describe them, I use this phrase a lot, displaced urban residents, people who couldn't afford the rents, people whose homes got foreclosed on, people who had catastrophic illnesses, and so they're on the streets because they couldn't afford to pay them, people who, for all kinds of different reasons, and because the housing is absurdly expensive now, because of the profiteering that is rampant and is not being controlled by authorities or by the community. Authorities, you can't expect them to control anything. They're paid off by these folks. They're elected by these folks, or with the you know, the powerful advertising from these folks. And it's the community that has to take action to make these changes, and that's what I'm often urging the community to do, sometimes direct action. But in any case, it's not a bad apple or two that's, you know, oh, if only if the homeless people behaved betterly, they wouldn't be treated like third-class criminals, you know, or second-class criminals, or, you know, Jews in Germany or blacks in Baltimore. Or no, it's deeper than that. It has to do with a real power imbalance in our society, just like there's an income imbalance. So, you're tuned to Free Radio and the rants of Robert Norse. That's me. I'm at 101.3 FM, in case you Haven't looked at your radio dial. No new word on transmitters sites, places where we can place our transmitter once the current site is foreclosed on, or a studio, which I mentioned appeared to be, we have it for about a month, and then we are going to likely get evicted, or at least have to deal with a new management, which may not want us here. So we are really seriously in need of listener support. I don't just mean money necessarily, though. Hey, send us your money, please. But I mean eyes on the street to find a place where this underground station can go and continue to exist. Please give me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-4833, if you have any thoughts, suggestions, or go to freakradio.org, where you can find our schedules, you can find applications, where you can find some archives, mostly of other shows, and you can also find contact information, how to reach us, because we need your help. And we're not getting much of it, I'm afraid. I hope we do. So, here's a little music, and I'll be back.
Thank you.
Another one by Phoenix, who you might still find downtown near Marini's with their Celtic harp. Yeah. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. Looking online, I see pictures of hundreds of people in Philadelphia at the Philly is Baltimore protest, described 41 minutes ago on NBC, Philly as Baltimore protest blocks traffic in Center City, turns rowdy. I guess the question is, are they going to be rowdy enough, or is it to actually impact what's going on in Philadelphia and in Baltimore? And I don't have much information about Philadelphia. Here's the, of course, the description is going to be about the protesters who broke through the lines and the arrests and the police officers who were injured and so forth, instead of what they were protesting about. And that's something I really want to emphasize around the Baltimore protests or the Ferguson protests or the Santa Cruz protests. It's the continuing activities that are being spotlighted that are really the issue, the continued cover-up of police murder or what certainly seems to be police murder at a distance. I mentioned before that Baltimore officers' names are not being revealed. The issues in Santa Cruz, I've raised issues of racial discrimination by officers like Bradley Barnett, and of course the obvious discrimination against homeless people, who get massive numbers of citations for sleeping. It may be that the DAP program doesn't chronically go after, particularly go after people who are sleeping downtown, most of whom have been driven away, or who are sitting next to a building, which still happens, or street jewelers getting outrageous citations, one of whom successfully beat one in court. Well, the officer didn't show up. The complaining person actually didn't show up. I think it was Julie Hendy of the city staff felt that the person who was showing goods had made goods that were not crafted, but that weren't really their creations. And I looked at the goods. They were, I think, jewelry. It didn't look particularly commercial to me, but I'm not an expert. And I don't think Julie Hendy is either, and she's a rather nasty example of a very repressive staff member who has been involved in a number of efforts to criminalize homeless people dating back to 2003 and before. The most notorious of which is the fence that's in front of Betty's Burgers. If you know Betty's Burgers downtown, there's a planter area that you used to be able to sit on right next to this, on the sidewalk next to Betty's Burgers. Now it is no longer sittable because she, as a staffer in the redevelopment agency, using complaints from the Pacific Trading Company, which the Hendricks owned and may still own, didn't like a musician, Cosmic Chris, playing near their door. I think he was actually more than 10 feet away from their door, according to the ordinances at that time, and couldn't play for more than an hour without getting a ticket, but that wasn't good enough for them. They didn't want him there, and they somehow felt, as merchants do, that they owned the sidewalk. So they were able to get the downtown redevelopment agency to get money from a police department budget, $6,000, to move a fence 4 inches. That's the green gate that's all the way around what is the pendulum area. If you know downtown, there's this big pendulum that you can swing. It pushes they've actually tried to cite and arrest homeless people, or at least cite them for pushing the pendulum, whereas kids and tourists are allowed to push that, or as they wish. I'm not sure they've done that recently, but that was the case in the past. Anyway, the area where people could sit down was eliminated by moving the, I guess, it's about 6 inches high, spiked fence area, 3 inches, 4 inches forward, so there's no place to sit. And if you try and sit on the spikes, which I suppose you could do if you want to do a little, well, if you have a strong butt, that's illegal. That's a conduct on public property that's criminal, just as it's illegal to sit down downtown on the berm, the cement berm, around a tree, even if you're not hurting the tree or the cement berm in any way. So, protests are continuing in Baltimore, in Philadelphia, and maybe even in Santa Cruz. I mean, tomorrow it is May Day, and you know, I'd like to think that there would be some kind of strong response to address our own militarization of the police here, which you saw the very tip of the iceberg with the Bearcat. And if you're homeless, you see a lot more of it. Or if you're interested in homeless issues, you see a lot more of it. If you've got your eyes on the laws and you see the curfews happening everywhere, in the parks, on the beaches, in front of City Hall, in front of the county building, around the police station, around the library, curfews that have nothing to do with any public safety issue, but that are simply designed to drive away poor people and that are enforced. Then you would become aware of the need for some real changes here in Santa Cruz and some real accountability. Not accountability, the Downtown Accountability Project's attempt to shift the blame to people who are drunk downtown, perennially arrested as drunks. It's a problem there is in every community. But the whole system of laws that doesn't have housing and services for people, and that creates such huge income inequalities that people work simply to pay rents and then find they can't even pay the rents that they're working for and have to move out of town. But their connections are here, so they come back, and they don't have any place to stay. In any case, I've often talked about laws against sleep are obscene, abusive, costly, stupid. I also hear there's a crackdown happening at the Red Church, where I frequently go on Mondays, almost regularly. I was told there on Monday by the pastor not to make announcements to the group of people there. I often tell them what's happening in terms of city council meetings, protests coming up, laws under consideration that are going to impact them. And this could have been a straw in the wind that was not what happened to be blowing that particular day, but wasn't going to continue. But I've also heard that now it is going to be, people are being told they cannot sit on the lawns outside at all. And this was the word that got to the Huff meeting yesterday. And if anybody has confirmation about this or information that would contradict this, I'd like to know. And, you know, why, what difference does it matter if one, you know, an hour or two every Monday, a certain area where you can sit down and relax is cut off? Well, you know, as I said, this happens little by little, a slice, the salami approach, where you keep cutting it off, cutting it off, cutting it off, and nobody really notices until it's almost all gone. And I think that's happened to a lot of public areas in Santa Cruz. And the Red Church is not a public area. The Calvary Episcopal Church at Lincoln and Cedar Streets is a, you know, privately owned area, but it is an area that's traditionally been a kind of refuge for poor people, at least during limited periods of time, increasingly limited, 2 hours on Monday, and at night on occasion when Joel Miller, the pastor, has said people can sleep there if they don't cause trouble, and that often happens. It may still be happening, for all I know. But, you know, this increasing trend of criminalization has to be pushed back, and I'm hoping that we'll be raising those issues in a way that garners the interest of other activists. who will be coming to the town clock tomorrow at 4:15 and 4:30 to celebrate May Day. Maybe there'll be a maypole and we can all strip down and dance. That's another traditional May celebration. Public fornication, perhaps? Probably not, although the weather certainly does seem to suit it. Anyway, interesting story from Philadelphia. A protest in response to recent events in Baltimore moved from Philadelphia's City Hall into Rittenhouse Square and eventually to the roads above the Vine Street Expressway. I don't know about any of these streets are, and I'm sure you probably don't either, you listeners, causing traffic problems leading to confrontations with officers around 8 p.m., that's 5 p.m. our time. Philadelphia police officers, some on horseback, and protesters pushed each on roads near the Vine Street Expressway. And if you see the, you can see the, actually there's some video of a huge crowd. It looks like hundreds of people and large numbers of police officers pushing each other. The point is that these protests are not dead. They're growing. And frankly, I'm glad they're growing. They need to grow. We need to do something similar here. You're on Free Radio with Robert.
You rang?
Oh, is this the City Council perennial hopeful, Steve Plaich?
Well, this is the former student hearing advisor, Steve Plaich.
Former? So you have a report on the Highway 6 and how they fared at their suspension hearings.
Yeah, I think they fared very well. I was the hearing officer, hearing advisor for three of the six, and Linda Regas, who you may have met, the attorney from Southern California with the National Lawyers Guild, was the advisor for the other three, Highway 6, but they acquitted themselves well. The hearings were very long. We had two hearings yesterday, in one morning and one afternoon, which each lasted 4 hours, and then one hearing this afternoon for each of the remaining Highway 6 students. It lasted about 3.5 hours, so a very long process.
What went on in those hearings, Steve? What kind of questions went down?
Well, it's basically what they call a clean slate hearing, what you would call in the law a hearing de novo, which means from fresh, from new. And so the conduct officer is called the adjudicator in these hearings, and there were four panel of usually a graduate student, an undergrad, and maybe another undergrad student, and then a hearing officer who is a university employee administrator. So the adjudicator lays out the violations of the student conduct code. It's all about the violations of student conduct code, and they could be disorderly conduct, you know, disrupting campus activities, preventing ingress and egress to the campus, bringing disrepute on the university, although that's not the exact terminology. So they lay out that case, and then the student rebuts all of those claims by whatever oral evidence he has. And then they bring in the police officer from the campus who shows a video of the demonstration, and then the student can cross-examine him, and then they go to a point where the student does some further explanation about his response to each one of the conduct violations, of which most of the students had five. One of them today, one of them had an extra one because he had on-campus housing, which he was then booted out of. And then the student can bring in his witnesses. One of the witnesses in a hearing that I was not in, because they run in parallel, was Mike Brock, and he testified for one of the six. Anyway, it's just an opportunity for the student to rebut the charges that the university is bringing to them, against them, for violations of student conduct code, on which they based what now is a four academic quarter suspension, but they will now confer and make a recommendation to the associate dean, who then makes a recommendation to the dean, and they will decide, number one, whether or not they violated one or any of those conduct code sections, and two, what the university's punishment should be.
Were you bored, Steve, or were you transfixed?
Well, it's an interesting process. I mean, I was there. You can't have lawyers really represent the students because it's an administrative process. However, I could be there to counsel them about what questions they should not answer because they have, of course, the Superior Court criminal case working. And so there are certain questions that they could not respond to and certain things they could not say. But they all acquitted themselves very well, I thought. So within the next few days, we don't really know what the timeline is, they'll receive notice of the hearing decision. And, you know, that'll be what they will take forward. There's one more level of appeal, and that would be from the dean who approves whatever the panel has recommended or some variation thereof. That there's also an appeal from that decision to the chancellor. And then that's the end of the administrative process.
How interested was the student body in this? Were there people outside supporting the students?
Well, the university did a funny thing, is that originally these hearings were supposed to be held at the Hotel Paradox, which would have been convenient for others. They're closed hearings, so not even the witnesses can go into the hearing room until they're called, and they're called separately. So instead of having it at the Hotel Paradox, where people could have come at least supported from outside hearing rooms, they moved it over to the university offices on Schaefer Road, right across from where the Homeless Garden Project is, which effectively isolated it from just about everybody. So there weren't really any support people there because they were in the middle of the day, for one thing, and for another, if you were there, you would have had to sit around for, I was there for 9 hours yesterday and five today. So it's a long time for people to sit around and not be able to really talk to the people they're supporting or even have any indication of how the hearing is going or what's going on with the hearing. It's not an open and transparent process.
How did the six bear up?
They bear up very well. As I say, I thought they also acquitted themselves extremely well. It's a very adversarial kind of a hearing. You have four or five, in some cases, students or university staff and one student. And so just because of the sheer numbers, you know, of us against them, I do think that the panels that we had, three panels, were very fair, and they let the students have as much time as they needed to present their cases. The hearings were originally scheduled for 2 hours, and they all went four. So there was no restriction of the time in which the students had to fully explain themselves. So from that standpoint, you know, they get an opportunity to say what they want.
What's the current status of the students regarding their suspension, their housing, and also
Well, currently they're all suspended for four academic quarters. They are barred from being on campus at all. Those students who live on campus are effectively rendered homeless, although they have found some housing, so they're not out on the streets. They don't have any access to university sponsored medical care. If they have jobs on campus, they can't pursue those. So they're effectively barred from campus unless there is some reduction of the suspensions as they stand.
What kind of questions were asked of the students by this panel, or were they asked questions?
Well, they were asked questions specifically addressing the conduct code violations. You know, do you feel that this was a dangerous situation? Do you feel that your actions threatened? And it's a very different situation because most of the case law on student suspensions only deals with students on campus activities. And as you know, this action happened off campus. So it's very different than what you would find in most campus hearings where they would say, well, you were on campus and you did this, and did that adversely affect campus activities? Did it bring the campus into disrepute? Did you prevent other students from going to class? Did you threaten other students? Were other students threatened by your behavior? That kind of thing is all centered on on-campus action. This, of course, is an off-campus action, and I suspect that at some point, the students, as you know, are represented by public defenders in their criminal court action. They're also represented by a fellow named Dan Siegel in any subsequent civil actions, which would take place after they exhausted all their administrative remedies. So there is still the possibility that may happen.
Well, let me ask you, what kind of precedents are you aware of that have, you know,